Welcome back to Following Noah on a Stormlight podcast. This week is episode 215, and we are in Tress of the Emerald Sea, chapters 19 through 31. Elliot, how are you?
I'm doing excellent. I don't know if you guys noticed or not, but two days before the day we're recording this now, was National Read a Book Day. And I gotta say, I've been very much enjoying curling up with a cup of tea and picking up this gorgeous book and flipping through its very well-designed pages. It's been a joy.
Are you a salt in your tea type of person or a honey in your tea type of person?
I said this before. Salt in tea sounds absolutely horrific. Please don't ever do that to me.
Paul, how are you?
Fantastic. While I don't like tea and I haven't been reading the physical books, I'm still doing really good. I feel like episode 215 it's not an even number, but it feels kind of like a fun even number of episodes to me, even though it's not. So I'm excited one way or the other. Yeah, I'm looking forward to coming in. I'll hand it back to you, Trevor. I've got nothing, but I'm trying to think of something which is means trouble. So
that's okay. We can talk about Tress. Let's roll intro and then discuss 19 through 31 of Totes. All right, Elliot, this is a solid chunk, I believe maybe the end of part three and most of part four of Tress of the Emerald Sea. What happens?
I'm going to do my best to summarize in as succinct a way as I can because our narrator is a little bit rambly. So here goes. We've got Tress and Huck who are on the pirate ship, just trying to get the lay of the land, figure things out. Huck is doing a little bit of spying, so they're learning a little bit about Captain Crow and the Cannonmaster Laggart, I think, and their plans to intentionally make the crew, what's the name for it? That they've
dead
killed
runners.
People. Dead runners, thank you. They've intentionally made the crew dead runners so that they have to follow them. Tress is still just trying to figure out what is this Captain Crow all about? What is she trying to do here? So learning a little bit kind of as they go. There's a great scene in chapter 20 where the helmswoman lets Tress guide the ship, and there's some really cool art in the book of that moment too, which kind of felt like a emerging moment for Tress as she discovered maybe a passion of hers, perhaps of sailing the high seas. What else here? Tress ends up becoming the sprouter on the crew. It's the only open position, I guess, so she volunteers and gets to work with the different spores that they've got. So she's learning a little bit about that, gets her own cabin with a bed and a shower. So pretty special. The only downside is she has to work with these incredibly dangerous, might kill you at any second, various types of spores, but she tends to do it really well. Seems like Tress is pretty good at picking things up, which works well for her. Huck and Tress have lots of conversations. They're figuring stuff out. Hoyt is cursed. We already knew that, but they're trying to get little bits and drops of information out of him. They end up attacking another vessel. Tress saves the day by patching the hole. Yada, yada, yada. We learn that Captain Crow is not human, or maybe she was human and is infested by something. A little bit of a crazy scene where I think it's one of the members of the other crew of the ship that they attack tries to shoot her, and a vine springs out of her face, catches the bullet, and defends her life. I don't think I was mentally prepared for that moment. But things proceed, and Huck and Tress are figuring out life on the ship. And then we do get, in chapter 31, so the last chapter we're going to talk about, I'm sure we're going to talk quite a bit about this chapter, actually. We learn quite a bit more about ethers and how they work, and also mention of a dragon. So lots to talk about.
So before I hand it to Paul, there is a mention of a dragon. However, I don't think that's the most exciting name drop in this episode. In chapter 31, there's a term that's dropped that I'm actually more excited to talk about than you know, measly dragon. Paul, what do you want to start with?
I hear you, Trevor, but a dragon has been formally announced. So
true.
That's all I'm focusing on for the rest of the book. I'm here to actually share a little bit about myself for one moment. This is unrelated to the podcast, but growing up in about fourth grade, I got a serious fascination with reptiles. I hated reading as a kid, but I would go to the library and check out textbooks about reptiles. And I learned as much as I could. I would make note cards about every different type of snake that I could ever find, or lizard or things like that. And I would present that, like, I would make my family sit down on the couch and I would present to them, this is a rosy boa. This is where it lives. And this is what it eats. And this is roughly its size and description and stuff like that. And I would go through all of them. And I knew all these facts and stuff. And so I've just always been a reptile fan, I guess you could say. So naturally, I'm super excited for a dragon. But I feel like that context is important as to why I'm so excited. Dragons are just super cool. So obviously, I'm looking forward to that. I will say, while I'm excited for that, what I really tuned into in this episode, and this is from our discussion in the previous episode, is all the different spores and all the different seeds that we're seeing. Tress is now our sprouter, and she's learning this. And I really like the perspective that she's learning this, so we are also being introduced to and learning this as well, is kind of fascinating and neat. I really liked it. And so I didn't really catch on to this in the previous episode. When we were talking about it was whenever it caught on to me about this whole magic system and the ways it's used and everything. So that's something that since then I really kind of zoned into, really kind of tried to pick up on. And I'm excited to talk about this. We get a mention of midnight spores as well. We find these infamous black spores, the midnight spores. And there's quite a bit to dive into with that. I won't go all the way into it right now because we might have more story stuff to talk about. But we get a mention of another bond. The Nile bond is mentioned, I believe, along with this other bond, the Luel bond.
Yeah.
And this seems massive. Like, it seems gargantuan to me. The Nile bond was a big deal. And I think this is a really big deal. So, yeah, I'm not necessarily pointing to a direction which I'm saying we should go, but those are my big highlights. Are there any of those that y'all are wanting to talk about? Or should we go through more of the storyline first?
I'll highlight the story real quick, and then I want to actually talk about the other crew members. So last episode, we met Fort and Anne were the first two. Who Fort is our chef, our cook, or the...
He's also the quartermaster. He's like quartermaster and chef.
Right. And then there's Anne, who is assistant cannon master and...
Carpenter?
Yeah, and the carpenter. Thank you. This Fort, episode,
go ahead, Paul. Sorry to interrupt. Fort is the one that they describe as really huge, right? Like, he's,
yes,
in their eyes, kind of a giant. And our questions were, is he maybe from Roshar? Is that what we talked about? Okay.
Elliot,
making sure I'm keeping everyone straight.
Yep. This episode, we get three more major introductions besides Hoid. We actually learn quite a bit about Hoid and what's going on with him in this episode. But the other three is Laggart. He is the head cannon master. He's the first officer of the ship. And he seems to be in on whatever Captain Crow is planning. He is frequently in secret meetings with Captain Crow. We have Soleil, who is the helmswoman. She controls the steering of the ship. And Sanderson actually goes into a little bit of a rant that Soleil can actually control a lot more of the ship than Crow can in all intents and purposes. So Crow can make a general order, but Soleil actually has full command of the wheel, whether Soleil order or whether Crow orders or not. So
it also, and then just to add to that super fast before you go on, it seemed like that was almost like a pirate code kind of thing, where that was an unwritten law that the helms person can overrule the captain or take the lead when they need to, sort of thing. Like in the scene where they're taking down the other ship, Crow goes to like full on attack and Soleil steps in and goes, no, it's explained a different way, but she basically says like, I'm pulling rank. I'm going over there. We're not going to kill all these people. That was a big scene that seemed a little like counterintuitive that the captain didn't have the drive there. So maybe like this secret, like pirate code that the helms person can take the lead in moments like that. It was interesting.
And we can go ahead and talk about this now. There seems to be actually a fine line that's being walked on the Crow song between the crew and Captain Crow. So Tress quickly finds out that it's not all black and white on the Crow's song. Captain Crow is trying to intentionally make dead runners of her crew, has successfully done so. Has the word got out? Not really. Do they have to sink another ship? Maybe. But the crew, which Soleil actually brings this up in that scene that you're talking about, Crow wants to attack this ship. Soleil wants to spare them. And Soleil confronts the captain like in front of the other ship and says, we didn't sign on to be dead runners. We signed up to be pirates, to be not be conscripted in the king's army or whatever was going to happen to them. But we're not going to do this. And so there's a bit of a standoff there, and then Crow backs down. So they go into a little bit of why Crow backs down, because Crow obviously wants them to be dead runners, but she also needs a crew. So does Crow have the power to kill them all? We'll talk about by the end of this episode. Yeah, probably. Like from the limited information we just got. Yeah. But, you know, she needs the crew. So there's an interesting line to walk there between trying to manipulate the crew into what she wants to do and not having them fully turn against her and, you know, ignore her and strand her on the sea or whatever. So do you guys want to dissect any of that any further, or do you want to talk about what's going on with Captain Crow?
Okay, one question relating to the crew. So Hoyd is a member of this crew, right?
Yes. He's the cabin boy.
Okay, the cabin boy. Yeah, he's not given like a specific role, right, on the ship? He's just, or is cabin boy the role? Is he maintained the cabins? I don't think that's what it was.
I think cabin boy does have a specific role. I'll look it up for you, but okay. I do believe he's officially part of the crew.
Gotcha. Okay. And then there's also this, is it Ulam?
The Condra, he's the doctor.
Yes. Okay. Okay. I was trying to get everyone straight. Ulam is an interesting character.
Very.
Rather peculiar. But okay. Just thinking of the other characters are, but mostly Ulam. Hoyd, we obviously see from plenty, but
a quick Google search. A cabin boy or ship's boy is a boy who waits on officers and passengers of a ship, especially running errands for the captain.
Okay. So a little errand boy Hoyd.
Yep.
It's kind of funny.
While we're talking about Hoyd, there's a moment where Tress finds out that Captain Crow specifically traded to get Hoyd. And like Hoyd is not there on accident. Crow sought out and got Hoyd for her crew, knowing that he's cursed. Probably, I think it's implied that she wants information maybe about the sorceress or about other things that Hoid might know, but he's not there by coincidence.
And Tress actually is doing the same thing that maybe what Captain Crow is as well. So you insinuated that Hoid might be there for a purpose. Tress actually figures out that Hoid had a run-in with the sorceress and then sits him down and asks him, okay, tell me everything you can about the sorceress. And he goes, I like pink socks. So there you go.
There's a chapter where they talk about it actually a little bit, and I think it's maybe narrator Hoid is explaining it to us and talking about how the curse that he has been hit with from the sorceress works on intent, and it like feeds on Hoid's intent and blocks him from saying certain things. So if he intends to explain his curse or how to break it or where the sorceress is, the curse stops him from doing that. And so there's a weird scene where Hoid, like the in the story, Hoid blanks his mind and like zones out intentionally somehow and is able to like squeeze out a hint to Tress, which I think actually leads her to find the Midnight Spores, is where that goes. But weird little scene where they try to like work around the curse.
I think it also leads her to go interrogate Huck, right?
Yes. Yeah, he talks about familiars.
Yeah. And then Huck gives the information of, you can talk about a curse so long as it's not your curse. So let's hypothetically talk about something else, and then I can explain those rules to you. So, okay. Interesting little specifics there.
We need to bunny trail on that for a second. You ready for this? The scene you're talking about, is chapter 29. The entirety of chapter 29 was bizarre. Bizarre scene. It's right after it. So you just said it. Hoid drops Tress some kind of hint about familiars. And Tress now has the knowledge like, oh, talking animals are familiars that have been cursed by the sorceress, or that have been, you know, magicked somehow by the sorceress. Now they can talk, and then they serve the, like a few random hints. So she goes and confronts Huck in chapter 29. Then they end up having the conversation that you just alluded to, Trevor, which I want to zone into further. Huck spends like 4 or 5 pages, which is a lot. These are big pages. Carefully explaining how to like talk around a curse. And like you said, he's saying, hypothetically, if someone out there were to be cursed, here is what you would do to figure out if that person is cursed. You need to ask about someone else's curse and say, if someone were cursed, what would it be? And then the cursed person can talk about it on and on, over and over. It seemed glaringly obvious to me that Huck is trying to get Tress to ask him those questions. And Tress doesn't pick up on it at all, one bit. Like over and over, Huck is bringing back to it, you need to ask them about someone else. And Tress is going, oh, yeah. That would work, wouldn't it? Ask the rat the question, and he can tell you whether he's cursed or not. Come on, Tress. Come on. You're way smarter than this. She's solved a lot of things so far. She's picking up on some clever stuff. And I think Huck was trying to get her down the train of thought for like 4 pages in the book, and she doesn't figure it out. I'm frustrated if you can't tell.
It was rather infuriating. It was so ridiculous. Do you still think that, you know, we talked some last episode about who Huck might be, or do we think that Huck is what's the name? Wesley, or, you know, in this case, Charlie. Yeah. Do we still think that's the case? Is he cursed? So Tress confronts him about being a familiar, right? And then he's like, no, it's not the same. I'm just from a family of talking rats, right? And you're like, okay, very convincing, you know?
He says, Yes, I am associated with the sorceress, but I'm not a familiar in the way you're thinking, is how he explains
it. Yes.
And Tress is like, okay. What? Come on, Tress. He didn't actually answer your question.
Seriously. Yeah,
what's going on?
I was about ready. Like chapter 24, 25, somewhere around there. I was starting to get convinced that we just had a talking rat on board. That was just going to be a thing. He's talking about his family. Oh, yeah, I grew up in this great family. And yeah, my parents are, kind of crazy, but we get along fine and we love each other. Like, okay, rat family. All right, maybe there's a whole island out there of talking creatures. And then chapter 29 hit, and I am now 100% convinced this is Charlie. No question in my mind. He is cursed. He's feeding all these lies because the curse is forcing him to. The sorceress is clearly like evil in the sense that she likes to mess with people. Just look at Hoyd for any question of that. She sent Hoyd out into the world with this goofy curse just to mock him, apparently. So sorceress, here's where things happened. Sorceress has gotten Charlie in her clutches, realizes that he is lovesick and has this beautiful girl at home that he loves so much. She's all maybe bitter because she's never had a love. So she curses him to go find her, live with her, but never be able to tell him who he is, just to be mean. That's what's happened.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think we've cracked the code. By we, I mean, I think Elliot has.
Okay.
But I'm on the podcast too. Yes. Exactly. All right. We'll reconvene. We'll have our wrap
up. Sunlit Man is up next, I think.
Yep. So would you guys rate the book?
Yeah. Yeah. Plot, not the strongest. We figured it out pretty quick. On that topic, though, one thing I wanted to say, though, is we're past halfway into this book, I think, roughly. We're in part four. I think there's six parts, right? Are there six parts in this book? I never know. Some books there's five, some books there's six. Brandon, make up your mind, please. And then Elantris had three, so could be anything. So, we're past halfway through this book. I've found myself in this book less interested in the plot, but growing to be very deeply invested in the world. Ooh. I have really, really enjoyed the world of Tress. I think the moons are really cool. At first, I wasn't all about these spores. I was like, this is way too cutthroat. It felt almost like a happy portrayal of a very dangerous, like Shadows for Silence in the Forests of Hell type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's still kind of the case. Like, it's very, unsafe to just exist on this planet. But I'm thinking about it. If you take away any of the safety concerns here, it's a very beautiful planet, I imagine. It seems like maybe one of the prettiest ones that we've seen. I can picture, I love the ocean. I love bodies of water. And so I picture all these basically different colored oceans. And I just think that's beautiful. Like, I think that's awesome to have like a midnight ocean, a bright red, crimson, the verdant sea or whatever, the green. I'm sure there's many others we haven't seen and stuff, but I'm just like the visuals and the aesthetic, I think is really neat. So I have found myself being really invested in the world. I think that took a big turn in the previous episode where, now that we're diving more into the spores, into this magic, I'm getting very intrigued. It's a very inquisitive magic system for me. I've been very curious about it. So overall, just throwing that out there that while the story has been fun, it's not the highlight for me this far, where I think the storyline in most of these books has been my highlight rather than the world itself.
So I'm going to couple the two different conversations we just had. If Huck is Charlie turned into a rat. What implications does that have for the rest of the Cosmere in other magic systems if you can turn people into talking animals? What is there anything that we've seen that might explain how that could possibly have happened?
We have a sword that talks.
True.
We have a squirrel that ran rampant through a couple houses a few times.
Has anyone turned into an animal?
Did Hoyd turn into an animal at some point? Did he like come out as like a dog or something?
Are there any known shapeshifters in the Cosmere?
Well, I mean, we got one on this ship here. We got Condra that turned into anything.
What else?
Well, Sleepless that turned into anything.
True. I've told you this on the podcast. I don't think we've read it on the podcast. In the Cosmere. Go ahead, Paul.
Mine was dumb. You shouldn't have let me go. I was going to say, if we haven't read it yet, is the Sunlit Man actually the Sunlit Dog? And he is a shapeshifter.
So the Sunlit Man is secretly just the dog and the dragon, the entire book.
Ooh.
Yes. And he plays both characters, the dog and the dragon. Yeah.
No,
he's a shapeshifter.
On the podcast, I've told you that dragons in the Cosmere are canonically shapeshifters. We have a dragon mentioned. And you're saying there's something going on with Huck.
You know, that leads into my Well, I see what you're saying. Maybe Huck is the cursed dragon who can no longer be a dragon because they've been cursed into becoming a rat.
Okay.
Which would be interesting. However, I now have the theory as of like 45 seconds ago that Huck is not Charlie. Huck is in fact the sorceress herself. And it's just part of a larger evil plot where at some point, you know, I don't know why the sorceress would care about Tress at this point. Maybe she found out about Tress from Charlie, and the revenge is not making Charlie live with Tress for vengeance that way, but instead to gain Tress's trust and then betray her.
There you go.
So there you have it. I think Huck is actually the sorceress.
Real quick, while we're spinning crazy thoughts about the whole book as a whole, I'll throw something in here quick. I've actually been confused a little bit by this, because coming off of all of our other Cosmere books, I'm kind of half expecting, maybe more than half, the sorceress to not be evil. That seems like something that Sanderson is good at, is he doesn't typically have black and white villains. There's a few in the Cosmere, but not a lot. And so far, the sorceress has been cast up until now as an extremely black and white villain. Everyone you talk to, oh, the sorceress is evil. Sorceress is evil. So I'm half waiting for the dragon is evil and the sorceress is misunderstood or something like that. But yet, I recall back to this being very much kind of following along with the guidelines of a classic fairy tale. And the classic fairy tale tends to have a very direct and non-vague villain. So maybe this is one of the stories where it's just the sorceress is the villain and that's all there is to it. I really don't know what to expect, actually.
You know what, Elliot? With that, if the sorceress is to become a black and like not a straight up villain, maybe misunderstood. If that's the case, I think we'll know pretty clearly, because I bet we will see from the sorceress's perspective at some point. I haven't looked ahead into the chapter titles, which I have been very curious to do and have actively refrained because there's a lot to be said about the chapter titles in this book. I feel like it's kind of clever in how these chapters are titled, I feel like, with the titles of different people, right? And so I'm wondering if you would see from the sorceress's perspective, you know, how maybe she, you know, there's a reason why she does this. Maybe she, quote, curses people and turns them into rats to save them or something like that. Who knows? We'll see. But that is interesting. I hadn't thought about that. But I think that'll be pretty instantly apparent if that is the case at some point.
I believe you recently predicted another man behind the curtain on this podcast. It was Trell. I think you predicted that Trell was a hoax.
Yep.
And that turned out to be false.
Very wrong.
So, 0-1, I guess, on man behind the curtain predictions, but one way to get back to a 50-50 win rate. Okay. Are we ready for a spore conversation? Because we got two different parts to a spore conversation. Part one. Elliot, in your brief summary, you incorrectly recounted the ship attack scene where there's the Crow's Song attacks another ship.
Yeah.
Soleil makes the standoff, saves the other crew. One of the other guys in the other crew, good friends with the cannon master who got shot, turns and points his gun at Captain Crow. Does not fire. You said he fired. Captain Crow shoots herself in the face.
Oh, yeah.
And her verdant spore pops out of her cheek and catches the bullet.
That's very true.
So what's going on with Captain Crow, gentlemen? She's got, and our Chandra in the next chapter sits Tress down and gives her a little lecture on exactly what's going on with Tress. What'd you guys learn?
The Spore Eater. Is that the chapter we're talking about?
I believe the Spore Eater is the one where she shoots herself in the face. I believe the next chapter is called The Extra Good Listener.
Oh, that's right.
Tress is sitting down with Ulam. Is that Ulam. His name?
Yes, Ulam. I will say, this is my once-a-book shout-out for Michael Kramer's reading. Ulam is quite an extreme character to listen to.
Yes.
Via audiobook. I feel like there's certain, the most notable character that comes to my head that is, I think, much more well delivered by audiobook that I probably wouldn't get reading the physical book is Wax from Mistborn Era 2. Wayne from Mistborn Era 2. And maybe Ulam is quite interesting to listen to. So it's been quite a hoot and a half listening to Ulam, but we are starting to learn a lot. This is something that's really fascinated me, like I mentioned, is learning about the spores. I know that they mentioned that our spore, quote, spore eater, that it's not actually like they're eating spores, right? It's something called like gestation or something like that. It's like a weird thing. There's a lot of weird wordplay in this. They talk about like something being fecund, and Tress is like, I can't say that word and stuff like that. Yeah. It was a bit funny. It was a bit like wild on the wordplay in this whole chapter.
I was actually thinking about that as well. I was listening to this today, and the different experience an audiobook listener and a real book reader would have with the wordplay here, because Michael Kramer really leans into it with the gestate pun, and Tress goes, she just ate what? And Ulan says, no, not just ate, gestate. And he does a really, really good job of delivering that. So, Elliot, what's Captain Crow ate a spore. What's going on?
Well, I think thankfully Ulam gives us a little explanation, so we can actually step it back a little bit before we talk about what is Crow, because he explains a bit about the ethers and says the ethers on this planet are overgrown and rabid, I think are two adjectives mm-hmm. that he uses.
Feral.
And yeah, feral was a really good word that kind of stuck in my mind for this. And he even refers to true ethers on other planets. And true ethers actually work with people and are a little more reasonable. So it's that explains a lot right there yeah. of what we're dealing with. It's these large magical powers, but maybe in a way that's a little bit run wild, which explains why this planet is so crazy dangerous, I guess. And so, okay, so we've got ethers. They're tied to the moons. They spill their spores down onto the planet. Apparently, they're after liquid. That is what Ulam explains a bit, that Crow is a host. Feeding liquid to the prime is what I wrote down in my notes. So the verdant ether has colonized Crow, I guess, and is feeding off of her liquid such that Crow is going to die. Crow is going to die by running out of liquid, which is why she carries a canteen around with her and drinks all the time. It's not the stereotypical pirate drinking rum or whatever all the time. It's just literally a canteen of water because she's getting super dehydrated because this ether is sucking all her moisture away. Which that alone is kind of funny spin on the stereotype.
You'll notice we've been on the ship for two episodes now. We've already stopped for water three times at different ports, if you've noticed.
So yeah. So what is Captain Crow? Apparently she has been infested by the verdant ether and is desperately trying to cure herself somehow because she's dying quickly.
Yeah. So she has a parasite from the verdant moon in her body that's eating her alive, and she's trying to satiate it.
Well,
and the distinction that you talked about to start there, I was under the assumption until this chapter, my first time, that okay, this is the planet where all the ethers come from. The guy we saw on the Lost Metal with his little ether buddy. He's been here, he picked up an ether, and he's got it as a little, like, he tamed it. Apparently that's not the case, and that there are specifically 12 ethers on this planet that have gone feral, gone rabid, and are eating anything they can find. So, and the Prasanva, our guy in the Lost Metal, who has a bond with his ether and like feeds it water, that's a more symbiotic relationship as opposed to a parasitic relationship, which is what we're seeing here,
which is not a super encouraging thought for just all these people. They're living in a really dangerous place, and it doesn't sound like it's getting any better. They're just one day all going to get consumed by these ethers
at some point.
But real quick, before we go and talk about bonds and dragons and things, I noted this is not explained in the chapter, but it's obvious from the scene where Crow shoots herself and the vine pops out and grabs a bolt, which, by the way, there's some beautiful color art of that moment in the book, which is super cool. The vines that are inside Crow seem to be a whole nother level of ether than elsewhere. Like, you shoot the cannonball, it sprinkles water on the ship, the vines spring up out of the ocean and kind of slap on the ship. That's very different than jumps out of your face fast enough to catch a bullet and save your life. Like, that is a whole nother level of awakened.
Intelligent. Yes. Awakened is an actually interesting term.
Yes. I was trying to use it intentionally. Oh, intelligent, sapient, like pick your word, but different level than just the drop your water in the ocean and a vine pops out. there's something, it's a whole nother level going on inside Captain Crow.
Yeah. Part two, Midnight Spores. Hoid tells Tress about six stars and press on him or something while he's trying to deliberately suppress his intent. Huck says there's stars underneath the bed. She goes and presses on it. There's a secret compartment, Midnight Spores. A couple chapters later, she's experimenting with said Midnight Spores. Well, actually, before she's experimenting with it, she goes and talks to Ulam about it, which is the smart thing to do before she experiments with it. And Ulam says Midnight Spores, otherwise known as Midnight Essence, are this whole thing, and there's a whole other bond that does not include the rest of the spores. It's a Stormlight reference, gentlemen.
It's so out of context, though, that I'm struggling with it. Normally, we get more vague reference to our other things, and we kind of dig into it and go, oh, maybe this could be similar to Roshar. Here it is, black and white. Well, actually, the book uses green ink in a lot of places, black and green. The very specific reference to the same name we saw in Roshar, Midnight Essence. There it is, word for word. That spins my brain in a million different directions because I've read Stormlight, four books of it now. I thought I kind of knew what I was dealing with Unmade and the Midnight Essence that we saw. And now you're going to tell me that you've got an ether, which in my brain is a whole different magic system with different being and different things, creates Midnight Essence on this planet? So what is like the other? This doesn't seem to... It behaves in a similar way. I see the physical similarities, but I'm having a really hard time reconciling how this fits into my Roshar lore.
I'm having a difficult time as well, but there's some thoughts bouncing in my head. For one, and correct me on any details, Ulam references that Midnight Spores are different from all the other spores. Correct. I don't remember the specifics of what makes them super different. But I know one of the things is they kind of need like a steady supply. It's not like, you know, you drop water onto a whatever other spore, it sprouts and does its thing. Midnight spores need like a steady supply. Is that right?
Yes.
So do they become like... Is that basically what we're seeing on Roshar is like Midnight Spores that have been fed water and then maybe commanded or something like that? I'm with Elliot in that I don't fully get the connection. Like, yeah, I hear your Midnight Essence and I think of the Midnight Essence that are in Dalinar's vision. But how did we get there? How did we get there from here, what we're looking at right now, and these spores in a box, you know?
Okay. So we saw the term Midnight Essence. Let's pause on Tress and go define Midnight Essence again, okay? So the term Midnight Essence is, Paul, you're exactly right, used with Dalinar's flashbacks. There is something extremely similar that shows up in current day Stormlight that behaves like Midnight Essence, but is never categorized as such. You guys remember what I'm talking about?
Well, the link that I was going to go to, which maybe is what you're talking about, is one of the Unmade that we see a lot of is named as the Midnight Mother. And yes, we get this long scene where Shallan does battle with Ray Shafir, the Midnight Mother, and there's all the black goo everywhere mimicking and imitating all the soldiers, and they have to fight it all. That's what I'm thinking also for this.
Right. And pick up Tress again for a quick second. It explicitly uses the term for Midnight Essence. It tries to mimic what it sees, is the term that Ulam uses for it. And then go back to that scene in Stormlight, Elliot, that you're talking about at the basement of Urethiru, whatever illusions Shallan throws at it, the Midnight Mother kind of distorts it and makes a mirror image of it, and it comes back. And there's this whole battle sequence of what you're talking about of Adolin and then an illusion of Adolin fighting like two dark illusions of Adolin. And it's a very odd scene. So now let's try to tie them together. We thought this was like an... Yeah, go ahead, Paul.
So are you saying that Ray Shafir is like kind of more like a mud puddle of water and midnight spores? It's just spitting back out images?
Yes and no. I'll get to that here in a second.
Okay.
Let's try to tie them together. So we made the assumption that the Dalinar flashback Midnight Essence were simply the spawn of the Midnight Mother, right? Like, that's a pretty easy conclusion to come to. There's an unmade hanging out around wherever this Dalinar flashback is. There's these oily skin things. They're described exactly the same. And, well, almost exactly the same. There's actually a couple key differences. But now I want to compare that to Tress, and that this is specifically an ether at work. And then I want to highlight the phrase that, oh boy, there's an unmade that talks to Shallan while they're in Kolinar. Who's the one that like is kind of going soft by the end of Rhythm of War? We get even a point of view from her in an interlude. Is it Jean Not?
Yes.
Okay, so Jean Anant makes the explicit clarification that the unmade were not made by Odium. They were unmade by Odium. They were warped by Odium. So now I would actually apply this, that there was an ether present on Roshar that Odium then corrupted into the Midnight Mother.
Is your thinking that the Midnight Mother, Ray Shafir, is the only one that's like that was an ether and then corrupted unmade into an unmade, or that all the unmade are ethers?
I doubt I'd go that far. I think I would just say that Ray Shafir was originally maybe a person with an ether. Or maybe an ether itself. I don't like however you want to define that or theorize about. There was an ether present on Roshar before Odium showed up, and then unmade either the person with the ether, or, you know, whatever. But are you tracking with me?
I am tracking. However, are we saying that that is Ray Shafir specifically? Or
yes.
Okay. But then how does that... I'm still lost on how does specifically the Midnight Spores or Midnight Essence get from here to... Because this is the same thing, right? This isn't like a different aether. Like, this is from the same thing, same source.
Both are Midnight Essence.
I mean, I understand that a lot of our investiture is used in a lot of places, not just the planet it originates. But I guess I'm still trying to piece how that could be, I guess.
Sure.
It seems like the ethers are creating the spores. Seems like, and this could definitely get revealed to be something different, but it seems like so far the ethers are on the moons in our Tress world here. And they are creating the spores and raining the spores down onto the planet. So, like, if Ray Shafir was a source of midnight ether spores, that could be an answer to that, perhaps, of the being can create those, that ether, that spore.
I would hypothesize... This is what I think. I think that Ray Shafir was on Roshar with a symbiotic relationship with the Midnight Essence, like we see in Prasanva, in the Lost Metal. He has a healthy relationship with this ether, and then Odium shows up and twists that or manipulates that, unmakes that, whatever that means. Odium is not the original source of it. So that's what I think.
Makes sense to me.
When I first read this, I was very excited to see a explicit Stormlight reference on page and get to theorize about it.
Well, it's funny because it almost changes your perspective. It's like, oh, Stormlight reference. And then you realize that actually maybe it's the Stormlight making a Tress reference.
Yeah, that's true. But then Tress is also confirmed canonically later than Stormlight, much later than Stormlight.
Yeah.
So
that was going to be my question, is where does this lie in our timeline? That's typically my question. If we're talking about Stormlight, I had another thing I was going to wait, but I feel like it may be more fitting now, of a minor, well, I don't know how much of a Stormlight prediction or theory this is, other than just a thought. We are looking at these spores, and specifically Captain Crow, our spore eater, who, you know, is infected and has to have all this water and stuff to fuel it. Is there any chance that cultivation is in some way connected to this? I'm asking because while it's different, it's not water. Lift needs food to supply her, like, as her investiture. Like, that's what fuels her power. Is that in any way connected to this? That could just be grasping at straws looking for a connection that might not be there. But it's made me think. And if we have possible aethers on Roshar or previously on Roshar, that's not in the realm of possibility for me, or that cultivation may have some tie to this as well. If Odium is corrupting an aether potentially, wouldn't it be possible that cultivation has some form of a connection to some as well? That could be how that was bestowed to Lift, because that's still kind of a mystery in my mind. We've kind of just been like, oh yeah, it's just the boon or whatever for Lift, but you know, but I think there's more to that still. So
do you have any thoughts? Go ahead, Elliot, before I weigh in.
Do you remember when we finally got the reveal of Dalinar at the Night Watcher? Do you remember the description of the Night Watcher?
Shout out to Jordy Rapture, who did our background. He has a great art piece of him meeting the Night Watcher and cultivation. That's what always shows up in my brain.
I just picture, I please do not make fun of me if I'm wrong, because I do not remember. But in my mental image is the Night Watcher is almost like a young woman. That could be totally wrong, but like a young, maybe even childlike.
I think girl. I think there is that aspect to it. I think you're remembering it well. And I think cultivation like refers to the Night Watcher as like child or something like that. But the description, the physical description of Night Watcher is this growing vine that like grows around and has a face on it. It's like Windle lifts Spren on steroids. I didn't think about it till just now. Growing vine magic being fits rather well with, I think, the thought process you were kind of running down there.
All right, Paul, I'm going to lend to your theory and then tear it down. You ready?
No, so, I'm not ready.
When we first meet Lift in Edge Dancer, or we're first getting to know Lift, I guess we've seen her before that, but when we're first getting to know Lift in Edge Dancer, Windle makes a comment that says, you really shouldn't be able to touch me and interact with me as much as you do. and then we never acknowledge it again. So back to your Night Watch, and we know that Lyft has been to the Night Watcher and Cultivation. So we obviously know there's something odd going on with Lyft, Cultivation, the Night Watcher. All of that is that there's certainly something odd going on there. However, when we get introduced to Ethers, it is explicitly told to us that Ethers are separate from shards. They existed before shards and have nothing to do with shards in general. So I would encourage you to think, I have heard this theory, Paul, that there's an Ether hanging out with Lyft or something's going on. Wendell is an Ether and doesn't know it, or, you know, something like that. Like Wendell and Lyft obviously have a bond, but Lyft has to eat all the time instead of Stormlight, as opposed to drink all the time, like we see with Captain Crow. So yes, I certainly have heard this one before. You're on the right track with a lot of other people, smart nerds around you.
Thank you.
But it's explicitly told to us in black and white that shards are not ethers. They pre-existed ethers. I'm sorry. Ethers pre-existed shards, and they are separate. They have separate rules. I track them.
Yes.
But yeah. Anyway.
Okay. If you hate me, Trevor, you can just say it straight up. You don't have to.
I don't hate you all.
No, I'm joking. No, that makes sense. And I was thinking, if there was supposed to be that connection, I feel like it would be very easy for Brandon to be like, yeah, Captain Crow has to just always be eating something, you know, like right. There is still a notable difference between eating and drinking water, given that the entirety of the spores on this planet are all around water. You know, that logically makes sense. So
do we want to talk about Tress running around as a midnight spore and then we can close the episode? She has like Hoid and then equally Michael Kramer does an excellent job of like the internal dialogue that Tress has with herself as she's a midnight essence, and she has important business to do, like scaring Huck and jumping around and being ridiculous and whatever. It's a very odd chapter. So obviously midnight essence is not all there, but it also makes Tress have like really odd impulses and thoughts while she's spying on Captain Crow.
She does seem to have literally mind melded with something. Because like you said, there's these desires and impulses to do shadowy things the whole time. And it grows stronger as she runs out of water, or I can tell if it was her succumbing to the will of the thing or just literally as her body runs out of water, the midnight ether, whatever it is gaining more and more influence over her. But yeah, it was a bizarre but very fascinating sequence.
Yeah. Is this where you guys thought we were going with this book?
Not wildly outside of the expectations. We started out very simply, and I very much expected we were going to go somewhere crazy with it because it's the Cosmere. Brandon's good at this kind of thing.
You can definitely tell in these chapters that this is a book that Brandon was just writing for fun. You know,
absolutely.
There is Cosmere stuff. It is a coherent, good story, you know, but you can tell he's not like he's just having some fun with it. You know, a lot of this is just he probably wanted to write what he wanted to write. And there's a ton of just aloof comparisons that Hoid makes and stuff and all these ad lib things and lines and one liners and stuff that I'm like, he's just having fun writing this. And I think that's great. Yeah. But with that, even though it is maybe less, a little less structured, there is some really neat stuff and neat reveals in here. And still, Brandon Sanderson manages to take a casual extra book that he's writing and give it massive Cosmere implications still and theory crafting things. So it's always crazy that that works out.
That feeds into my weekly question. Would you give this book to a Cosmere newbie? Is there anything in these sets of chapters that would disqualify it?
I think so far the answer to that question for me is no. No, it does not disqualify it. Yes, I would give it to a new Cosmere reader. There is tons of stuff that it's going to go way over their head. But that might actually be really fun for a Cosmere reader to read Tress, miss all this stuff, and then one day come back to it after having read a dozen other Cosmere books, pick it up and go, how did I miss all of this stuff? That would be a fun experience to have as a Cosmere reader, I bet.
I will say, I agree with Elliot. And at the end of the day, I think I would hand this to a new Cosmere reader. I think my apprehension with it is actually Hoyd as the narrator. I feel like if you're thrown in and this is your first Brandon Sanderson, first Cosmere book, you're a bit confused by the narration style here. You're a bit confused by all the references. And while I think the magic system thus far is very cool, it feels like a bit much. Like, I feel like I would be selective maybe with who I would recommend this to. I feel like a precursor would be like, you have to have read other fantasy or something, in my opinion. I could be wrong about that. And there's still like half the book left to determine that. But I think that's honestly my biggest apprehension is Hoyd as a narrator is I personally have loved it, but I feel like that's, you know, a new reader wouldn't get it as much. I feel like you'd be kind of like, okay, why is this crazy cabin boy telling the whole story? You know?
Mm-hmm. I agree with you, Paul. In Tress specifically, more than Yumi, it's way over the top. Like, Hoyd is really in your face. And if you know of Hoyd, if you understand the irony and the context and the jokes, it's fine. And I think it lends to the story. If you hand it to a new reader, though, they might be like, I sat at the wrong lunch table. I don't get these jokes. And this is really awkward.
That's a very fun way of describing it, Trevor, actually, as I sit at the wrong lunch table. That feels a little bit true. It's like, well, I love inside jokes. I'd love to be a part of one day, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. All right. Anything else before we close the episode?
Since one more thing. Since you didn't make us do a spell check on it, I'm just going to straight up ask you guys, how do you pronounce the name of the dragon? They talk about it in chapter 31 here because Tress, as the midnight essence rat thing, finds Captain Crow's book, discovers that Captain Crow is trying to get to the dragon at the bottom of the Crimson Sea to be cured because apparently this dragon can do that kind of thing. But the name of this dragon just looks like Brandon had a random letter generator and hit go.
Well, I can answer this. I could not spell it, I anticipate. Given the way it sounds, I thought it wouldn't be too hard. correct me if I'm wrong, Trevor, but I believe it's pronounced in the audiobook as Zysis.
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 That's probably close to how I would have guessed it. Zysis. And then, but we discover halfway through the chapter, that's a shortened version of the name. There's a second time they mention it and it's longer. And the longerness of it makes it even more weird. I don't know if you guys remember how that was said.
I don't think I remember this one, Trevor.
The whole thing is Zeiss-a-Riffle.
But
Zeiss-a-Riffle?
Okay. Zeiss-a-Riffle.
But there's like, yeah, Zeiss-a-Riffle? Yeah, it's wacky.
Go ahead.
Zeiss-a-Riffle. Sorry, what was that?
Go ahead. Go ahead, try to spell it.
Zeiss-a-Riffle? I mean, I'll give it my best bet, but this is probably going to be the worst one yet. Okay, okay, first, I'm going to start with Zeiss.
Yes, just go for Zeiss. You'll get it wrong.
Okay.
But before you go and we reveal this, there are a lot of audiobook listeners who spell it Zeiss.
Okay.
We are going to blow their minds here in a second.
Okay. First off, Zeiss was one of two options in my head. So, you know, I'm there with a bunch of other people. If that's the case, can I ask for one hint? I'm assuming, are there silent letters in this? Can I know that, or am I totally in the dark?
Not really.
Okay.
But I'll give you a hint. It does not start with a Z.
Okay. So we have an X instead of a Z.
Okay.
Is my guess. Either that or it's an SZ, like Zeth or whatever.
Mm.
But I'm going to go with X. I'm going to dragon's name started with X sounds cool. Zeiss is X. I'm going to go with XICIS. Zeiss.
Okay, do you want to try the second half of the word?
Okay, say it. Can you pronounce it again?
Zeiss-a-Riffle.
Zeiss-a-Riffle.
Is that really how they say it in the audiobook? Because he's never going to get it if that's the pronunciation.
Hold my beer.
You asked if there's a silent letters. There's just like a silent syllable at the end of the word.
Zeiss-a-Riffle. Okay. I'm going to double down on how I did the other one. If I don't have confirmation on whether that was close or not, I'm going to go Zeiss-a-Riffle. Okay. I'm going to go XI. I'll stay with C. XIC. Okay, I'm going to go. This is just, I can't even keep track anymore. XICIA. R A P H. This is the most lost I've been on any spell check.
This is the part where Simon Cowell hits the button that goes.
I don't hardly have anything. X I C. I'm lost for letters. I almost lost for words. I've got nothing.
X I S I S is Zeiss.
Okay, so I was getting fancy with the C, but other mm-hmm. than that, real. I would have had it.
X I S I S, R E F, L I E L.
So Zeiss-a-Riffle.
Yes.
Something like that. Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, that guy is a dragon at the bottom of the Crimson Sea, and Captain Crow wants to get there.
See, I'm puzzled because something had to inspire that name.
If you're looking for baby names, Zeiss. There we go. Spelled X-I-S-I-S. There you go.
Okay. Wow. Yeah, something had to inspire the long name. It was probably the same place he got inspiration for Numahuku Makiaki Aya Lunamore, you know?
4 years
where on, it was like, let's just make a big, long, confusing name, you know?
I bet Brandon was playing an MMO and somebody ran past him with this name and was like, yes, I'm stealing that.
Honestly, that's how most of the best names come about, so.
True.
I'd believe it.
All right. We can close it there. Thanks for joining me, Paul and Elliot.
See you later.
So long. Farewell.